Hi listeners, and welcome to the David Crit Podcast. My name is Britt Lawton, and today I've got the privilege of sitting with Stephen Carton Barber, and we're going to be speaking a little bit about the content of his book, African Game Species and Subspecies. So welcome, Stephen. It's good to have you with us today.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Cool. So I think a good place to start would be if you could give us a brief overview about who you are and how you came to publish this book.
Oddly enough, my background is not in wildlife. My background has been in business, but for 25 odd years, I owned and operated a game ranch up in the Limpopo River Valley. But long before that, I've always had a passion for Africa's wildlife and bought more books than I care to remember. I've visited many, many places all over Africa, from the rainforests of Cameroon to the plains of Kenya, Namibia, Botswana, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Swaziland, etc., etc., not to mention South Africa with its own rich diversity of game. But my book deals with all of Africa's game. It's not just Southern Africa. And most importantly, what differentiates it from other books is that it looks at Africa's game at a subspecies level. People tend to think a giraffe is a giraffe, not realizing that in fact there are 9 different giraffes. And as you look at the book and you look at the photographs, you can just see the total differences between them. As a matter of fact, talking about the giraffe, in 2017, the Seckenberg Institute in Germany did DNA research on giraffe and actually concluded that there are 4 species of giraffe, not subspecies, but 4 species of giraffe, which cannot interbreed. The very northern species, which has 3 subspecies, unfortunately for each of those subspecies, there's less than 300 animals left in the wild. And I make the point in the book that if you don't know about the existence of an animal, how can you even hope to save it if you don't even know it exists? We all have been very concerned about the rhino, and rightly so. But at the same time, the northern white rhino has virtually gone into oblivion. Right now, there are 2 cows left. The bull died a few years ago.
Oh my goodness. And how is it that you come about the stats? Do you do personal research with this?
Yes, this was several years of dedicated hard work. I'd been collecting information over a period of many years, but when I actually decided to sit down and do the book, it took me 2 years. And I thought at the time I knew a lot about African game. I very quickly realized that I did not. So when you really get into the research, it's just a voyage of discovery. Things people just don't know about, down to something about the common warthog. Everybody there, warthog, warpumba, we all know warthog. Okay, not realizing there's several subspecies. But more importantly, there are in fact 2 species of warthog. The common warthog and then the desert warthog. The desert warthog has a major difference in that it has no incisors. And if it does have them, they never protrude above the gum line. And in fact, their DNA split from the common warthog some 1.5 million years ago. And in the areas in the Horn of Africa where their ranges overlap, they cannot interbreed. But most important about that is the fact that there are 2 subspecies of the desert warthog. The other, there's the Somali warthog, which I've just spoken about in the Horn of Africa. But then there was the so-called Cape warthog, which supposedly went extinct in 1861. That was when the last sample was sent actually to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
However, while I was doing my research, at first of all, I'd never heard of the desert warthog, so that was a surprise to me. But then while I was doing my research, I found 2 very authoritative texts which both made the claim extinct, but may still occur in the Northern Cape. Now, the description of the warthog, which visually, desert warthog are 2/3 of the size of the common warthog, much lighter in color, many fewer bristles. The points of the ears fold over, and a very distinguishing feature is that the warts on the face hook and bend down at 90 degrees. Now, I have been speaking to people in the Northern Cape who claim to have seen warthog like that.
Okay.
So a next project is to actually go to the Northern Cape, try and collect DNA samples and see if we can see if the Cape warthog actually still does exist.
Right. So two questions I have for you is, how do you distinguish a species from a subspecies? What's like the technical...
All right, this is a very good question.
Okay.
I'm asked this question often. What makes it a species? What makes it a subspecies? As a general rule, but this is not a hard and fast rule, but as a general rule, the biological species concept says that species cannot interbreed.
Okay.
Now, that holds true for most species, but eland have been known to crossbreed with kudu, even though they share the same range. It's a very rare occurrence, and it tends to be in captive situations, but lechwe and waterbuck have been known to interbreed. Back here, very commonly, black wildebeest, which is definitely an own species, and blue wildebeest have been known to interbreed and produce fertile offspring. So this does happen, red hot to be some blessed book. So it's not a hard and fast rule, it's not a perfect rule, but more or less it does work. On the other hand, subspecies can interbreed, but they are generally separated by geography. And you do, of course, find hybridization where ranges do touch on each other. So for instance, a reticulated giraffe found in the Horn of Africa, okay, is a very, very different animal from the giraffe that we have in the Kruger Park. You look at the photographs, they are markedly different,
yeah,
and coincidentally cannot interbreed.
And then what you've covered in the book, is it only visual and or is it biological differences that you kind of...
Well, I like to believe that my book actually has two target audiences in mind. Number one, just as a coffee table book, and you want to stand up there and have a look at over 500 color photographs of all these different animals and what differentiates them. However, for the more seriously inclined, I do deal with the taxonomy of the animals, every description, every one that has ever been done. So typically for an animal, there'd be a description, and then 7-8 people come later and describe the same animal, but obviously with a different name and so on. So it's a bit of a minefield. But also knowing the Latin meanings of the species names, the genus names, where they come from, etc., etc. And of course, it doesn't just come from Latin. There's a lot of Greek in there as well.
Did you ever come across any new species that wasn't as thoroughly written about or researched?
Well certainly this Cape water is most certainly a case in point. But there are new species. As recently as 2010, they described a new species of dika found in West Africa, Walter's dika.
And who do you work with in terms of like getting those biological names if you're not aware of them?
Well, there's a huge amount of information out there. You just got to know where to go and look for it. Okay, but I spent a lot of time getting a lot of the early descriptions going back to an incredible number of species and subspecies were described in the late 1800s as in particular the British Empire expanded. The British Museum was describing hundreds and hundreds of different species, both fauna and flora, every month. So going into those records, the London Zoological Society, different publications of the time and so on, all that information is there.
So you had to backtrack quite a bit in terms of like...
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Just to try and make sure you're on top of things. And then, of course, there's no guarantee that I have been. I have no doubt at some point in time... Well, I've had that already. I had identified one subspecies. I didn't identify it. It had been identified and described of the common warthog. And I've had some academics who've done very recent DNA research who've said, that's not a valid subspecies.
Okay, wow.
Okay, so that does happen. But this is the nature of academia and the nature of everything, that there will continually be updates to
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Absolutely.
Maybe we're not describing that many new species now, but there are still things that are going to pop out.
Yes. And then can I also ask where you source your images from for the book?
Unfortunately, my own photographs are rather subpar. So I was forced into purchasing from a lot of the photographic agencies that
okay.
were representing many, many wildlife photographers all over the world.
Right.
And that tends to be the more common stuff. Then as soon as you start looking for certain very specific, less known animals, give an example, Wayne's dika. There I had to get hold of researchers in the field in the equatorial rainforest who had camera traps. And then you're not always getting the best photographs, but at least you can get them. There are dika on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, huge, size of an impala, weighs 70 kilograms. Abbott's dika, and they just aren't photographs available. As a matter of fact, the only one I could get was taken off a camera truck. I had to do a little bit of Photoshop work on it to get it looking okay, but it certainly does illustrate what the animal looks like.
And could you give us a little bit of insight into how you designed and published your book?
So the book itself was published by an organization that I'm now involved with, the African Wildlife Subspecies Foundation. We started it literally because of the book, actually. Mm-hmm. Realizing that there is this incredible variety of subspecies out there which people just aren't aware of. And as an aside, I make the comment in the book that if we're not aware of it existing, how are we going to save it? And that really is the issue. So the actual design and layout I did myself. I was quoted some rather prohibitive numbers by book designers, and I decided that I could do as good a job and do it myself. So it was a little bit of a trial and error thing to get going, and certainly I had to teach myself a desktop publishing software package, but those are skills I now use in a variety of other fields.
Exactly, that's totally admirable, and congratulations on creating
All the distribution maps, although I must admit my daughter and her boyfriend gave some assistance with the distribution maps.
Sorry, will you just explain what a distribution map is?
Okay, so I've got a map which shows the historic distributions of one of the subspecies. There's nearly 500 subspecies described in the book. So we have a distribution map which will show the historical range, and then I have a separate distribution map which shows the present range. Now, I've never seen that done in any other publication before. Typically, you have a distribution map. This is where, you're not sure. Is this where you used to find them or where you still find them? Mm-hmm. Or is it some compromise or something in between? But I do on opposing pages, and as I say, there are nearly 500 distribution maps in the book in full color, showing each subspecies where it historically occurred and where it now occurs.
Yeah.
And some of them, of course, are frightening. You look at some of the maps and you say, is that all that's left? Giraffe in particular, especially in the northern part of Africa, their distribution ranges are down to a fraction of what they used to be.
And it's always so crazy to see it visually. I mean, it's one thing hearing numbers, but seeing the visual...
You know, I knew all of this, but even for me, when we did the maps, to actually look at it in front of you is shocking.
Mm.
If we don't do something about Africa's game, so many of these subspecies will disappear.
Yeah.
Of the northern species of giraffe, which is in three subspecies, the Nubian, the Kordofan, and the Western, okay, all three of those subspecies are down to less than 300 animals left in the wild. I mean, that could disappear. And I mean, with all the nonsense going on in Kordofan, I don't even know if that number's still valid today.
Mm. No, it's terrifying when you start looking at that. So now, what is your involvement in conservation with animals?
Well, I think other than doing this book and now starting this foundation, which we're looking at a big project to actually do a natural history museum, which actually depicts all these different subspecies, but that's a big 1 billion rand project, which is slowly gaining a little bit of momentum. Certainly, I spent 25 years a game rancher. A lot of people just don't realize the incredibly important role that the game ranchers have played in this country. Back in 1960, there was only about 500,000 head of game in South Africa, most of which was in Kruger. Today, there are 13,000-14,000 commercial game ranchers, and the game count in South Africa, and this is a 2017 figure, was 17.5 million. I don't think people in this country realize to what extent game ranching has played an incredible role at saving the wildlife of Southern Africa in particular. I don't go as often as I used to, but I used to do 8-9 trips to the Kruger National Park a year. And it's over 20 years ago that I last saw a sable antelope in Kruger. Now, I know the particular area where they're more common, and it just happens to be an area I haven't really gone to, but in the rest of Kruger, you do not see the sable antelope. I was with a friend of mine, and we were on a game ranch, and we actually stood up on the back of the vehicle, and I said to him, from where we are standing right now, we can see more sable antelope than there are in the entire Kruger Park.
Wow.
Just from where we're standing right now, we can physically see more sable antelope. And that's sobering.
Mm.
Something that bugs me just a little bit is that there's an obsession with going to Kruger seeing Big Five. We just want to see the Big Five. As soon as we've seen the Big Five, we've done it. Not realizing the incredible importance of the other species, not as fancied, but also the subspecies. And I often do a talk and I say to people, and I've done this to honorary rangers clubs in this country,
yeah.
And I've asked them, what subspecies of eland occurs in the Kruger National Park? And I get a lot of, I don't knows, but I also get a lot of people who say the Cape eland. And very rarely do I have people who say Livingston's eland, which is the eland which we find in the Kruger National Park.
Okay, and what are the distinguishable?
Well, the big difference with Livingston's eland are that from a coloration point of view, they tend to go more to a light brown color, whereas the Cape eland, the cows tend to be brownish as well, but they will tend to go to a grey-blue colour. And, of course, the old bulls lose their hair completely, and then just what all that shows through is the dark blue skin. But Livingston's eland have white stripes on their sides, which the Cape eland does not have.
Okay.
And another very important distinguishing feature is they have a big black patch behind the knee.
All of them?
All Livingston's eland, not Cape eland. Yeah. So if you see a Livingston's eland, you'll see a black patch behind the knee.
Interesting.
And the white stripes, which are the most distinguishing feature.
Okay. And with the subspecies, are there any or ever any behavioral distinguishes between the species?
There are, but very minor. They're still part of the same species. The issue to understand with subspecies is that they are progressing down a different evolutionary path.
Yes.
If you looked at a roan antelope and a sable antelope, they're part of the same genus, it's very easy to see why. And they had a common ancestor at some point and started to diverge and now end up as two completely separate species. And that's, again, another little slogan which I have in the book, is that the subspecies of today are the species of tomorrow.
Oh, crazy, yeah.
So it is critically important that we actually look after all our subspecies.
For sure. And then, were there any species that you researched in the book that you didn't see physically, or that you never?
No. Several. Okay. Certainly, a lot of the North African gazelles and so on. I've seen some in zoos in the world, but physically seeing them in their natural habitat, no.
Yeah.
And then certain antelope in their natural habitat, especially in North Africa, have just about disappeared. The scimitar horned oryx being one, although there has now been a project to reintroduce them.
Yeah.
And of course, two of the biggest areas where you can find scimitar horned oryx in substantial numbers are Texas and South Africa.
Texas?
Yes. Oh, Texas has a massive exotic wildlife breeding setup in Texas. And there are many, many species and subspecies of African animal which are being bred in large numbers in Texas.
Hmm.
Texas doesn't have the limitations on their game laws that a lot of other states in America have.
Uh-huh.
But certainly if we go and look at the eastern bonga, which is only now found in the Aberdare Mountains in Kenya, their numbers are down to, I'm not even sure it's hundreds, it's possibly even closer to dozens. However, in the United States, there are many hundreds of the eastern bongo that have been bred there. And that's an important thing to do, because one disease in the Aberdare Mountains could wipe out the entire natural population. And at least having other populations in other parts of the world, it does allow you to repopulate into the original habitat. And that's what's happened now with the scimitar horned oryx.
Mm. Mm. And are you working on any major projects at the moment?
Not relating to wildlife. I'm busy with a few other things at the moment. I have rather eclectic tastes in all sorts of things. So and then there's business in between.
Yes.
And I've got to put bread on the table.
Of course.
But I have another little project brewing in the back of my mind.
Okay, good to know.
Okay, so watch this space.
Okay, will do. And where can people find out more about the foundation that you're a part of?
In the book, there is an email address and a website, although the website mainly just deals with the book at the moment, info@African Wildlife Foundation.
Okay, I thought for a second there you're going to be like, you're going to have to get the book to find out more.
Well, I did want to give you that punt, but I was just holding back just a little bit. But of course, you are the only bookstore that now sells my book.
Yes, which is very exciting. So, I mean, I think that's a sure sign that people have to come by if they want to find out a bit more about any of the facts that you've given.
They've got to get it from your bookstore.
Exactly, which is wonderful. So thank you so much for sharing it with us and for being here today. I appreciate
Absolutely, my pleasure.
And yeah, we look forward to what's to come, and hopefully we can have a conversation soon in the future.
I'd be delighted.